Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Eugenio Duarte. I hope you enjoy the interview you're about to listen to. If you do, or if you have ideas for books you'd like to hear about on the show, let me know. Go to my website, eugenioduartephd.com, and click on Contact to send me a message. And now on with the interview. Hi, everybody. This is New Books in Psychology, and I'm your host, Eugenio Duarte, in Miami. Today, I'm interviewing Susan Apatow, editor and contributing author, along with Zachary Baron Shemtov, of the anthology New York After 9/11, published in 2018 by Fordham University Press. Dr. Susan Apatow is a social psychologist and professor at the City University of New York, where she is a core faculty member of sociology at John Jay College and of psychology at the Graduate Center. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Delighted to have you. So the subject of the book is the aftermath of the terrorist attacks of 9/11. First, as a point of clarification, does it address the aftermath for the country or New York City specifically?
Yeah, the book is predominantly focused on New York City. It would have been enormous to have focused on the whole country, and New York itself is so complex that it was, you know, still required, you know, focusing more closely on particular times and particular spheres of life in New York City. But the events in the whole country and in the world do play a role in New York City. And so they're definitely in the book, but the book is about New York City.
So what made you interested in this topic for a book?
Well, I'm a lifetime New Yorker. I was born here, and I'm very interested in cities. One of the authors of the book told me that his teacher told him, and he's an architect, that cities are the largest human artifact. And as a psychologist interested in people, interested in behavior, and interested in ongoing lives, the city is the context in which most of my experience has been developed. I love visiting other cities, but New York City is of special interest because of the way it's changed over my life. So when 9/11 happened, I was in Boston. I was teaching at UMass Boston, still living in New York City, and had difficulty getting home. And I became convinced in the day after that this needed to be tracked. I was teaching in a conflict resolution program, a multidisciplinary program. And I wanted to understand what the conflicts and challenges and changes would occur in the future. And I started keeping track of New York Times articles on New York City after 9/11. I just wanted to have data that gave me a way to understand what could happen after an event such as that, which was clearly an event of enormous proportions. It was clear from the very moment I learned about it while I was still in Boston.
And when did you decide that this needed to be a book?
Ah, well, the book. So I was collecting these articles. There were quite a few thousand of them. And after 6 years, stopped, because at that point, the articles had drifted off the first page of the New York Times, off the sections of the New York Times, and were in smaller articles toward the back. And I felt like I had enough to have a sense of which spheres of life were very important to the public discourse. When the 10th anniversary was approaching, I decided to do a commemorative panel on the event. Based on the research I had been conducting, I asked several people to present because they were knowledgeable about the spheres that had emerged as really important spheres. So we held a symposium at the Graduate Center of City University of New York, advertised as widely as possible on the web, on the radio, invited anyone from CUNY in New York City to come. It was free. And the response to it was really quite remarkable. It was as if everybody there had lived through 9/11. It was only 10 years later. And yet everyone felt like they had a bit of tunnel vision, that they had focused on particular aspects and not others, so that when somebody spoke, for example, about Islamophobia, they were thinking about some other problem. When somebody spoke about elevators and tall buildings, they had been thinking about something else. And the way that the symposium, which was about 10 different talks, brought the many spheres that we had been studying together just struck people as so important, and everybody leaving said, this is so important. And so we decided to do a book. It just seemed that we could expand it to a few other spheres. We had more time, and to make it into something that would be a rich first-hand historical document that would be of use to people in the future. As some people said, a book like that would only become more valuable because the firsthand knowledge of the intricacies of the conflicts and the challenges and the changes, a lot of that gets lost over time. The stories become a bit more linear, and the nuances of the challenges, I think, become less obvious. So in this kind of a book, we have the ability to understand psychology as it's lived by people in different spheres of New York City, New York City's life, and the way that those spheres speak to each other in a kind of kaleidoscopic way is kind of beautiful because the issues are similar and different. And each one has, it's like each one is like a strong thread in a tapestry.
And the book contains chapters that examine the after effects of 9/11 from these various perspectives. And I want to name some of them. They include, of course, psychology, but also medicine, community advocacy, architecture, and several others. And so I want to make sure I understand the premise of the book. You're saying that you thought it was important to understand how 9/11 in New York changed, at least in New York City, changed medicine, changed community advocacy, how it shaped architecture for the future. Am I understanding it right?
I think it's more how 9/11 changed New York City, but New York City in these various spheres. So, for example, in the two chapters by the architects on what happened at Ground Zero in terms of a master plan, which Daniel Liebeskind wrote, and in terms of building the memorial, which Michael Arad wrote, we saw how the event itself challenged them to rethink a very large area in New York, 16 acres, and how that would be then reconfigured and redeveloped in ways that were appropriate to the history of the site and as well as to its function, which is actually, I mean, it had been a center of finance before.
So let's talk about that, because one of the chapters very much address, or maybe more, address what happened to the space where the attacks happened and all the debates that surrounded it. First of all, how would you characterize some of the debates? What were people arguing about when it came to what would happen to that space?
Well, there are many stakeholders. You know, there's in one of the chapters on conflict and change, in the book, we describe the public voice and how the public voice was very much a part of the planning initially. There were huge groups of people meeting at Jacob Javits Convention Center, which is a very large meeting space, to discuss what they wanted. The design proposals were vetted by citizen groups and the families of victims of the attacks. And so the stakeholders who were discussing what would happen to this space were incredibly vast and varied. They included the governor of New York and New Jersey, because the Port Authority of New York, which is New York and New Jersey, owned that site. The publics that had used the site as a business site, this transportation that goes through the site. So many people are involved in going to New Jersey through the tunnels and using the subway to other parts of the city. It's an endless number of stakeholders, and everybody did want to have a voice. Ultimately, as we describe in the chapter on conflict and change, the public's voice faded over time, and the stakeholders became much more politicians, designers, architects, and the talk about what would be there was very prominent in the news for 3 years, from 2002 to 2004. And there were questions about, how long it was taking to clean up the site. The site itself became a focus of activity for thinking about what had happened. But, that wasn't the only place that 9/11 had an effect in New York City. It had a pervasive effect on many systems in New York. The employment patterns had changed. In the beginning, many industries, the garment industry in Chinatown, taxi drivers were very much hurt. Those were two that were studied. Were hurt by the disasters, but that whole area of Lower Manhattan has since undergone enormous change and has become a very expensive area, residential, and it wasn't before. Before that, it was pretty much renters and not very expensive area to live in. So a lot has changed. Go ahead.
Well, and I'm sorry. I was just wondering of all the things that have changed. I'm also wondering about the psychology and the personality of the New Yorker. I think you might agree, our listeners would agree that New Yorkers, the New Yorker has a particular kind of personality. And I'm wondering if, in your observation, not just as a researcher, but as someone who's lived in New York her whole life, do you think that 9/11 changed the personality of New Yorkers, changed the psyche of New Yorkers?
Such a great question. The way that people came together after the event was extraordinary. Everybody wanted to help, but so people all over the world wanted to help. And I think that after disaster in general, people are very generous and very concerned about others, which is a very beautiful thing. I think that there is a kind of a tenseness in New York. A few years ago, a plane flew a little too close in the air to the buildings in our airspace. It was an error, and it was in the front page of the New York Times. I mean, everybody was pretty freaked out by it. Just hearing that sound of a plane too close was not good. And there are moments that I was at 9/11, of course, this last September, and the way that, people came together there, not only to honor the people who died on that day, but to honor the people who died in the years since from exposure to toxins at the site. These were first responders of many, many kinds, not only fire and public safety, other kinds of public safety, but also construction workers, engineers, Many kinds of people were down at the site to be helpful. How New Yorkers have changed? Well, I think we have. You know, the United States hasn't had an attack on its soil in hundreds of years, and from another country. And we have lived through such an attack. It was, you know, thank goodness, very short lived, but it was deadly and calamitous. And I think that people are different after that experience. They're, you know, the research on PTSD, you know, spoke about the declining intensity of PTSD over time in a wonderful chapter by researchers at Columbia University School of Public Health. But for some groups, it declined less, and those were the first responders. And interestingly enough, was particularly high for non-traditional first responders. These were volunteers who came of their own reconnaissance. And the authors don't know the reason, but hypothesize that it might be that the traditional first responders, who, for example, work for the Emergency Medical Service of New York City, had resources to enable them to recover and camaraderie, whereas people who came from other parts of the country and volunteered and come in may have not had that kind of support after.
So just to be clear, you're saying that the research shows, and this is documented in your book, that these non-traditional first responders, in other words, volunteers, maybe people who had come from another state, that they show more adverse long-term consequences compared to the more traditional first responders?
Yeah, well, I think by long-term negative consequences would mean that the PTSD didn't decline at the rate that it did for other vulnerable populations.
I see. It's
declined less than it did, and even declined less than for traditional first responders like fire, police, and EMTs.
You know, for transparency, I moved to New York City in 2008 myself and lived there for 10 years and actually just left New York late last year. And my first job there in 2008 was as a pre-doctoral intern at Pace University Counseling Center, which is just blocks away from...
Right there, right.
It's from Ground Zero. And I remember when I arrived in New York and when I walked around the neighborhood, I mean, I knew even before getting there that it was downtown close to Ground Zero. But when I remember when I saw for myself the site at the time in 2008, it was really just a big pile of fenced off rubble. And
right. It
stayed that way. I remember it stayed that way for a long time. And I remember wondering then, it's something I still wonder about now. I remember wondering, well, why have they left it this way? What's going on? What's holding things up? And as the years went by and I continued living in New York, I feel like I too got used to this fenced off eyesore, really. And looking back on it now, I wonder how that affected the way that people registered and held space in their mind for the events of 9/11. If we could have a site like this destroyed and have it take so long for us to put something back together, to reconstruct something, like how did that affect people, and did it say something about how we were processing that trauma?
Yeah, I think it speaks both to people and to the way that trauma affects sites and people and the interaction among them. And this is like a fundamental, it's like a core theorem of Kurt Lewin, who talked about human behavior as a consequence of the people, of P for people and E for the environment. And here, what you're bringing up is exactly right, that there was, it was hard. I mean, 8 years. So in 2000, that was not very long. It takes a long, long time to rebuild in cities. You need agreement on what to build, who will build it. There's all the permitting processes. When I spoke to Michael Arad, who built the Memorial Plaza, 2 years ago, he said it's still a construction site, but it's getting there. And there are parts that are still fenced off. Daniel Liebeskind explained that some of the buildings planned for the master plan have not yet been built. So it's really going to take many, many years for that site to actually be complete. And it may never be, quote, complete if all the buildings aren't built or there are, further complications. But when the memorial opened, you had to go through security to get into the site, and there was only one entrance. And now it's really like an open park, so it's quite different. And I think it feels to people who work and live downtown now more like a space that's doing maybe a triple role of being an intensely evocative memorial site. Almost a park where there are benches and trees and outdoor space, and you can see kids playing there, people talking, having lunch. So kind of a normal park in that way. And then it's also a work site for many people. The buildings, there are buildings that function as work sites. I think cities are complicated places, and I think that the evolution of the site itself in some ways isn't metaphor for the, recovery of New York. And as you point out, the recovery is physical and it's psychological, and the two are related.
I am also wondering about the recovery process as it concerns intergroup relations. I think we saw after 9/11 a rise in Islamophobia and almost like a felt justification for it in some parts of this country, that we now had reason to be afraid of certain groups. Did that happen in New York? And if so, how was that dealt with? How because New York prides itself and should be proud of how diverse it is. How did 9/11 affect intergroup relations, particularly around the Muslim population, and how has it dealt with it ever since then in the long run?
Yeah, it was pretty disastrous for the Muslim population. And there is some wonderful research on the effect on Muslim youth. One of the chapters in the book by Diala Shamas, who's worked with the CUNY, she's working at CUNY Law and the CLEAR Center, did an incredible study on Muslim youth attending CUNY campuses. And what the New York City Police Department did after 9/11 was assume a federal role of terrorist surveillance. And in the book, Charles Jennings, who's a public safety expert and professor at John Jay, describes that whole process and how that happened. And it was, as he describes, a form of overreach. There were people who, the students never knew who was an informer, who was not. It was quite traumatic too. Muslim student associations didn't know who was monitoring them, who was not. And, for most of the students, it was a chilling time for them. And this is in the aftermath. This is the years that followed. In the immediate aftermath, there was a lot of anger that from irrational types. I mean, people who would get out of a car, walk up to a taxi driver and punch him because he was wearing a headgear. He was, the one that they punched that I saw personally, which was just horrifying to watch, was Sikh and not Muslim. And had he been Muslim, so what? But there was it didn't enrage people. And, we know from history that people can become enraged at minority groups. And it's happened, repeatedly. And it was an extremely unfortunate time. I felt that New Yorkers did come together for that. But, of course, we're a heterogeneous group, and different people have different feelings, attitudes, behaviors, a sense of values. And so it was a very difficult period for groups that were perceived to be Muslim. I know that oftentimes Muslim young women, or I just know it from what I've read. So you know, did not wear the hijab because they didn't want to stand out. And this is, you know, really a terrible thing in a society that prides itself on pluralism. And in the chapter on conflict and change, there's a description of the controversy that arose in 2010 over building a what was called the Ground Zero Mosque. And it was neither a mosque nor at Ground Zero. It was supposed to be a cultural center modeled on a, you know, YM or YW CA, which would have community classes, facilities, and also have, you know, a chance to have, you know, discussion groups and learning. And it would have some Islamic related activities. So it would be very much like, you know, YW, YH, young, you know, Young Hebrew, Young Christian Association. And that was pretty much supported in New York. It was supported by the people in the community. It was supported by the community board. It was supported by local people, supported by the mayor, but absolutely hated by people, for example, in North and South Carolina. Somebody was running for Congress on a plank against the, what they call the Ground Zero Mosque, and, you know, some right-wing politicians in Europe. I think that although 9/11 brought out the very best in us in the way that we collaborate and care for each other in very important and deep ways, it also brought out some of the worst in how people became very fearful of minority groups in our midst and viewed them with suspicion. The fact that the New York City Police Department took that up and surveilled Muslim populations, you know, in mosques, in coffee shops, outside New York City, they didn't stop at the city borders, in some ways was one of the more really unfortunate responses to 9/11. And it lasted for years. And I think that the book is important.
Well, did it end?
I don't know. I mean, the fact that this happened.
No, but finish your thought, please.
Well, I was just going to say it was really one of the more unfortunate things. And one of the things that the book can do, I think, is as a kind of a lesson for future times, that if something happens, don't jump into, you know, blaming some group for our problems in ways that distract from the process of rebuilding and try to, you know, rebuild in constructive ways, not destructive ways. That was the end of the thought.
Well, can you say more then about, because you do mention in the book how you intend this to be a kind of case study that other folks who study disasters or other cities or people who are trying to recover from one, that they might learn from the experience of New York City. What about the experience of New York City post 9/11 can be... What can folks learn from it that is generalizable to other cities facing similar kinds of disasters?
Well, there are several things. There is very specific professional knowledge that people have gained in the aftermath. For example, in 2016, when Brussels was bombed, the occupational medicine doctors there called their colleagues in New York for advice on what to do. So that they had, you know, in the chapter on health, you know, this is described, and there's a lot of knowledge in New York that can be used elsewhere. And I'm sure other people have called other people. I mean, there's much has been learned. But I think in terms of the politicians who pretty much set the tone in some ways for our lives after disasters, we turn to them because they're the people who decide, you know, when the transportation will run, where it's safe to go, what communications are available. That I think that in my message for them would be to value community voice, foster inclusion, and be very transparent about decisions. You know, the tragedy of the health crisis afterwards that New York is still experiencing, people who are exposed here. Of course, there were people exposed from elsewhere who came here, is that there wasn't transparency early enough about what the dangers were, even though it was known what was in the substances, the toxic substances that people were inhaling and exposed to on their skin. We're told it was, in the beginning, they were told it's fine. You know, people who died there, you have a cough, you know, suck it up. But we do know now that people, you know, developed severe respiratory illnesses, cancers, and many, many, many people have died of these illnesses at this point. So I think that we need to rely on the decision makers to make decisions that are very, very cautious in the beginning. The precautionary principle is to take the highest level of precaution until you can be sure that you can bring it down, rather than the opposite, which is assuming everything is okay, and then, you know, later on saying, oops, it wasn't. You know, apparently Oklahoma City, which had a major bombing in years before that, which is an American terrorist, a lot of people were saved from toxic pollution because there was a rumor that there was a second bomb. And so a larger area was cordoned off. And had that happened in Ground Zero, had they cordoned off a large area, many, many people would have been spared exposure. So the precautionary principle, just assume the worst and then ramp it down as you get better information, will be much more protective of people. And we expect our officials to protect us.
Well, Susan, we are almost out of time, but before we go, we would love to know what you're working on now or what you've got coming up next.
My work is actually on conflict, which shouldn't surprise you, and also justice and the relationship between the two. And I'm working on a book on that topic because it consolidates my entire professional career is on these two topics. So that's what I do in my spare time. And I'm still teaching, which I love.
Well, I hope that when the new book comes out that you will be in touch, and we would love to have you on the show to talk about that book.
Oh, thank you so much. This is a pleasure. It's really wonderful to speak with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's wonderful to speak with you. And again, I've been speaking to Susan Opitau, co-editor and contributing author to the book New York After 9/11. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you so much.